The Stone of Pain. When Arran woke, a grey fog hid the sea and the dunes and hills of Celidor. The breakers came murmuring in a low thunder out of the fog, and withdrew, murmuring into it again. The tide was in, and the beach much narrower than when they had first come there. The last small foam lines of the waves came and licked at Ged's outflung left hand as he lay face down on the sand. His clothes and hair were wet, and Arran's clothes clung icily to his body, as if once at least the sea had broken over them. Of Cobb's dead body there was no trace. Maybe the waves had drawn it out to sea. But behind Arran, when he turned his head, huge and dim in the mist, the grey body of Orm Embar bulked like a ruined tower. Arran got up, shuddering with chill. He could barely stand, for cold and stiffness and a dizzy weakness, like that which comes of lying a long time unmoving. He staggered like a drunken man. As soon as he could control his limbs, he went to Ged, and managed to pull him a little way up the sand above the wave's reach. But that was all he could do. Very cold, very heavy, Ged seemed to him. He had borne him over the boundary from death into life, but maybe in vain. He put his ear to Ged's breast, but couldn't still the shaking in his own limbs and the chattering of his teeth to listen for the heartbeat. He stood up again and tried to stamp, to bring some warmth back into his legs, and finally, trembling and dragging his legs like an old man, set off to find their packs. They had dropped them beside a little stream running down from the ridge of the hills a long time ago when they came down to the House of Bones. It was that stream he sought, for he couldn't think of anything but water, fresh water. Before he expected it, he came to the stream as it descended onto the beach and wandered mazy and branching like a tree of silver to the sea's edge. There he dropped down and drank, with his face in the water and his hands in the water, sucking up the water into his mouth and into his spirit. At last he sat up, and as he did so, he saw on the far side of the stream immense, a dragon. Its head, the colour of iron, stained as with red rust at nostril and eye socket and jowl, hung facing him, almost over him. The talons sank deep into the soft, wet sand on the edge of the stream. The folded wings were partly visible, like sails, but the length of the dark body was lost in the fog. It didn't move. It might have been crouching there for hours, or for years, or for centuries. It was carven of iron, shaped from rock, but the eyes he dared not look into, the eyes like oil coiling on water, like yellow smoke behind glass, the opaque, profound, yellow eyes watched Arran. There was nothing he could do, so he stood up. If the dragon would kill him, it would. And if it did not, he would try to help Ged, if there was any help for him. He stood up and started to walk up the rivulet to find their packs. The dragon did nothing. It crouched unmoving and watched. Arran found the packs, filled both the skin bottles at the stream, and went back across the sand to Ged. After he had taken only a few steps away from the stream, the dragon was lost in the thick fog. He gave Ged water, but could not rouse him. He lay lax and cold, his head heavy on Arran's arm. His dark face was greyish, the nose and cheekbones and the old scar standing out harshly. Even his body looked thin and burnt, as if half consumed. Arran sat there on the damp sand, his companion's head on his knees. The fog made a vague, soft sphere about them, lighter overhead. Somewhere in the fog was the dead dragon Orm Embar and the live dragon waiting by the stream. And somewhere across Celidor the boat looked far, with no provisions in her, lay on another beach. And then the sea, eastward. 300 miles to any other land of the West Reach, maybe. 1,000 to the inmost sea. A long way. As far as Celidor, they used to say on Enlad. The old stories told to children, the myths, began as long ago as forever, and as far away as Celidor, there lived a prince. He was the prince. But in the old stories, that was the beginning, and this seemed to be the end. He was not downcast. Though very tired and grieving for his companion, he felt not the least bitterness or regret. Only there was no longer anything he could do. It had all been done. When his strength came back into him, he thought he would try surf fishing with a line from his pack. For once his thirst was quenched, he had begun to feel the gnawing of hunger, and their food was gone, all but one packet of hard bread. He would save that, for if he soaked and softened it in water, he might be able to feed some of it to Ged. And that was all there was left to do. Beyond that he could not see. The mist was all about him. He felt about in his pockets as he sat there, huddled with Ged in the fog, to see if he had anything useful. In his tunic pocket was a hard, sharp-edged thing. He drew it forth and looked at it, puzzled. It was a small stone, black, porous, hard. He almost tossed it away. Then he felt the edges of it in his hand, rough and searing, and felt the weight of it, and knew it for what it was, a bit of rock from the mountains of pain. It had caught in his pocket as he climbed or when he crawled to the edge of the pass with Ged. He held it in his hand, the unchanging thing, the stone of pain. He closed his hand on it and held it. And he smiled then, a smile both sombre and joyous, knowing, for the first time in his life, alone, unpraised, and at the end of the world, victory. The mists thinned and moved. Far out through them he saw sunlight on the open sea. The dunes and hills came and went, colourless and enlarged by the veils of fog. Sunlight struck bright on the body of Orm Embar, magnificent in death. The iron-black dragon crouched, never moving, on the far side of the stream. Past noon the sun grew clear and warm, burning the last blur of mist out of the air. Aaron threw off his wet clothes and let them dry, and went naked, save for his sword belt and sword. He let the sun dry Ged's clothing likewise. But though the great, healing, comfortable flood of heat and light poured down on Ged, yet he lay still. There was a noise as of metal rubbing against metal, the grating whisper of crossed swords. The iron-coloured dragon had risen on its crooked legs. It moved and crossed the rivulet, with a soft hissing sound as it dragged its long body through the sand. Aaron saw the wrinkles at the shoulder joints, the mail of the flanks scored and scarred like the armour of Ereth Akbe, and the long teeth yellowed and blunt. In all this, and in its sure, ponderous movements, and in a deep and frightening calmness that it had, he saw the sign of age, of great age, of years beyond remembering. So when the dragon stopped some few feet from where Ged lay, and Aaron stood up between the two, he said, in Hardik, for he did not know the old speech, "Art thou Khalesin?" The dragon said no word, but it seemed to smile. Then, lowering its huge head and sticking out its neck, it looked down at Ged and spoke his name. Its voice was huge and soft and smelt like a blacksmith's forge. Again it spoke, and once more, and at the third time Ged opened his eyes. After a while he tried to sit up, but could not. Aaron knelt by him and supported him. Then Ged spoke. Kalesin, he said. Sen vanisayan arok. He had no more strength after speaking. He leaned his head on Aaron's shoulder and shut his eyes. The dragon made no reply. It crouched as before, not moving. The fog was coming in again, dimming the sun as it went down to the sea. Aaron dressed and wrapped Ged in his cloak. The tide, which had drawn far out, was coming in again, and he thought to carry his companion up to drier ground on the dunes, for he felt his strength coming back. But as he bent to lift Ged up, the dragon put out a great mailed foot, almost touching him. The talons of that foot were four, with a spur behind such as a cock's foot has, but these were spurs of steel, and as long as scythe blades. "So, Briost," said the dragon, like a January wind through frozen reeds. "Let my lord be. He has saved us all, and doing so has spent his strength and maybe his life with it. Let him be." So Aaron spoke, fiercely and with command. He had been overawed and frightened too much. He had been filled up with fear, and had got sick of it, and would not have it any more. He was angry with the dragon for its brute strength and size, its unjust advantage. He had seen death, he had tasted death, and no threat had power over him. The old dragon Kalesin looked at him from one long, awful, golden eye. There were ages beyond ages in the depths of that eye. The morning of the world was deep in it. Though Aaron didn't look into it, he knew that it looked upon him with profound and mild hilarity.
"Arwa Sobriost," said the dragon,
and its rusty nostrils widened so that the banked and stifled fire deep within them glittered. Aaron had his arm upon Ged's shoulders, having been in the act of lifting him when Kalesin's movement stopped him, and now he felt Ged's head turn a little and heard his voice.
"It means mount here."
For a while Aaron didn't move. This was all folly. But there was the great taloned foot, set like a step in front of him, and above it the crook of the elbow joint, and above that the jutting shoulder and the musculature of the wing where it sprang from the shoulder blade. Four steps, a stairway. And there, in front of the wings and the first great iron thorn of the spine armour, in the hollow of the neck there was place for a man to sit astride. Or two men, if they were mad and past hope and given up to folly.
"Mount," said Kalesin in the speech of the making.
So Aaron stood up and helped his companion to stand. Ged held his head erect, and with Aaron's arms to guide him, climbed up those strange steps. Both sat down astride in the rough mailed hollow of the dragon's neck, Aaron behind, ready to support Ged if he needed it. Both felt a warmth come into them, a welcome heat like the sun's heat, where they touched the dragon's hide. Life burnt in fire beneath that iron armour. Aaron saw that they had left the major's staff of yew lying half buried in the sand. The sea was creeping in to take it. He made to get down for it, but Ged stopped him.
"Leave it. I spent all wizardry at that dry spring, Lebanon. I am no mage now."
Kalesin turned and looked at them sidelong. The ancient laughter was in its eye. Whether Kalesin was male or female, there was no telling. What Kalesin thought, there was no knowing. Slowly the wings lifted and unfurled. They were not gold, like Orm Embar's wings, but red, dark as rust or blood or the crimson silk of Lorbainry. The dragon raised its wings carefully, lest it unseat its puny riders. Carefully it gathered in the spring of its great haunches, and leapt like a cat up into the air, and the wings beat down and bore them above the fog that drifted over Celador. Rowing with those crimson wings in the evening air, Kalesin wheeled out over the open sea, turned to the east, and flew. In the days of high summer on the island of Ali, a great dragon was seen flying low, and later in Osidero and in the north of Ontuego. Though dragons are dreaded in the west reaches, where people know them all too well, yet after this one had passed over and the villagers had come out of their hiding places, those who had seen it said, "The dragons are not all dead as we thought. Maybe the wizards are not all dead either. Surely there was a great splendor in that flight. Maybe it was the eldest." Where Kalesin touched to land, none saw. In those far islands there are forests and wild hills to which few men ever come, and where even the descent of a dragon may go unseen. But in the 90 isles there was screaming and disarray. Men rode westward among the little islands, crying, "Hide, hide! The dragon of Pendor has broken his word. The archmage has perished, and the dragon is come devouring." Without landing, without looking down, the great iron-coloured worm flew over the little islands and the little towns and farms, and deigned not even a belch of fire for such small fry. So it passed over Geith and over Surd, and crossed the straits of the inmost sea, and came within sight of Roke. Never in the memory of man, scarcely in the memory of legend, had any dragon braved the walls visible and invisible of the well-defended isle. Yet this one did not hesitate, but flew on ponderous wings and heavily over the western shore of Roke, above the villages and fields, to the green hill that rises over Thwiltown. There at last it stooped softly to the earth, raised its red wings and folded them, and crouched on the summit of Roke Knoll. The boys came running out of the great house. Nothing could have stopped them. But for all their youth, they were slower than their masters and came second to the knoll. When they came, the patterner was there, come from his grove, his fair hair bright in the sun. With him was the changer, who had returned two nights before in the shape of a great sea osprey, lame-winged and weary. Long he had been caught by his own spells in that form, and could not come into his own shape again until he came into the grove, on that night when the balance was restored and the broken was made whole. The summoner, gaunt and frail, only one day risen from his bed, had come, and beside him stood the doorkeeper, and the other masters of the Isle of the Wise were there. They saw the riders dismount, one aiding the other. They saw them look about with a look of strange contentment, grimness, and wonder. The dragon crouched like stone while they clambered down from its back and stood beside it. It turned its head a little while the archmage spoke to it, and briefly answered him. Those who watched saw the sidelong look of the yellow eye, cold and full of laughter. Those who understood heard the dragon say, "I have brought the young king to his kingdom, and the old man to his home." "A little farther yet, Kalesin," Ged replied. "I have not gone where I must go." He looked down at the roofs and towers of the great house in the sunlight, and he seemed to smile a little. Then he turned to Aaron, who stood tall and slight, in worn clothes and not wholly steady on his legs from the weariness of the long ride and the bewilderment of all that had passed. In the sight of them all, Ged knelt to him, down on both knees, and bowed his grey head. Then he stood up and kissed the young man on the cheek, saying, "When you come to your throne in Havna, my lord and dear companion, rule long and well." He looked again at the masters and the young wizards and the boys and the townsfolk gathered on the slopes and at the foot of the knoll. His face was quiet, and in his eyes there was something like that laughter in the eyes of Kalesin. Turning from them all, he mounted up again by the dragon's foot and shoulder, and took his seat, reinless, between the great peaks of the wings on the neck of the dragon. The red wings lifted with a drumming rattle, and Khalesin the eldest sprang into the air. Fire came from the dragon's jaws and smoke, and the sound of thunder and the storm wind was in the beating of its wings. It circled the hill once and flew off, north and eastward, toward the quarter of Earthsea where stands the mountain isle of Gaunt. The doorkeeper, smiling, said, "He has done with doing. He goes home." And they watched the dragon fly between the sunlight and the sea till it was out of sight. The deed of Ged tells that he who had been Archmage came to the crowning of the King of all the Isles in the Tower of the Sword in Havna at the World's Heart. The song tells that when the ceremony of the crowning was over and the festival began, he left the company and went down alone to the port of Havna. There lay on the water a boat, worn and beaten by storm and the weather of years. She had no sail up and was empty. Ged called the boat by name, "Lokfar," and she came to him. Entering the boat from the pier, Ged turned his back on land, and without wind or sail or oar the boat moved. It took him from harbour and from haven, westward among the isles, westward over sea, and no more is known of him. But in the island of Gaunt they tell the story otherwise, saying that it was the young king, Lebanon, who came seeking Ged to bring him to the coronation. But he didn't find him at Gauntport or at Realbi. No one could say where he was, only that he had gone afoot up into the forests of the mountain. Often he went so, they said, and did not return for many months, and no man knew the roads of his solitude. Some offered to seek for him, but the king forbade them, saying, "He rules a greater kingdom than I do." And so he left the mountain and took ship and returned to Havnor to be crowned.
The End. You've been listening to The Farthest Shore by Ursula Le Guin, narrated by Robert Inglis. This book is copyrighted 1972 by Ursula K. Le Guin. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Dr. Illuminatus, The Alchemist's Son, by Martin Booth, narrated by Stephen Crossley. Real magic is dangerous magic in this modern-day battle against the dark side of ancient alchemy. When siblings Pip and Tim move with their parents to an old English country estate, a mysterious boy named Sebastian, the son of a medieval alchemist, emerges from behind a wall and claims that he's been asleep for nearly 600 years. What's more, Sebastian reveals that they're all in great danger. Enhanced by chants, herbs, and potions drawn from real texts, this is a tale of high action and history, science and magic, certain to cast an irresistible spell. We also recommend Maximum Ride by James Patterson, narrated by Nancy Wu and Ed Sala. Fang, Iggy, Nudge, the Gas Man, Angel, and Maximum, six kids who are 98% human and 2% bird. They grew up in cages, living like rats, but now they're free. When the bloodthirsty erasers, half-men, half-wolves, genetically engineered by sick and sinister scientists, kidnap little Angel, the flock embarks on a rescue mission, full of non-stop action, adventure, and soul-seeking, not to mention a little bit of saving the world on the side. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another Recorded Book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call the toll-free number found on the back of this book. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse our catalog, place orders, hear about our latest releases, or tune in to narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.